is a San Diego stockbroker. According to DiCarlo, when Sandy joined the family, sometime early in 1968, she had some $6,000 in stocks, which she sold, giving the money to Manson. She and her baby were now on welfare. Both girls had started college, then dropped out, Squeaky attending El Camino Junior College in Torrance, Sandy the University of Oregon and San Francisco State. Squeaky had been one of the earliest members of the family, I later learned, casting her lot with Manson just months after he got out of prison in 1967. They were the first family members I had talked to other than DiCarlo, who was a fringe member at best, and I was immediately struck by their expressions. They seemed to radiate inner contentment. I'd seen others like this, true believers, religious fanatics, yet I was both shocked and impressed. Nothing seemed to faze them. They smiled almost continuously, no matter what was said. For them, all the questions had been answered. There was no need to search anymore, because they had found the truth. And their truth was, Charlie is love. "Tell me about this love," I asked them. "Do you mean this in the male-female sense?" "Yes, that too," they answered, "but that was only a part." "More all-encompassing?" "Yes, but love is love. You can't define it." "Did Charlie teach you this?" I asked, genuinely curious. Charlie did not need to teach them, they said. Charlie only turned them around so they could look at themselves and see the love within. Did they believe that Charlie was Jesus Christ? They only smiled enigmatically, as if sharing a secret no one else could possibly understand. Although Squeaky was 21 and Sandy 25, there was a little girl quality to them, as if they hadn't aged but had been retarded at a certain stage in their childhood. Little girls playing little girl games. Including murder? I wondered. "Is your love for Charlie, say, different from your love for George Spawn?" I asked Squeaky. "No, love is love," Squeaky said. "It's all the same." But she'd hesitated just a moment before answering, giving the impression that though these were the words she was supposed to say, there was heresy in them, in denying that Charlie was special. Perhaps to overcome this, she told me about her relationship with George Spawn. "She was in love with George," Squeaky said. "If he asked her to marry him, she would." "George was," she went on, "a beautiful person inside. He was also," she added, in an obvious attempt to shock me, "very good in bed." She was quite graphic. "I'm not that interested in your sex life, Squeaky," I told her. "But I am very, very interested in what you know about the Tate, LaBianca, Hinman, and other murders." Neither expression changed in the slightest. The smiles remained. They knew nothing about any crimes. All they knew about was love. I talked to them for a long time, asking specific questions now, but still getting pat answers. On asking where they were on a certain date, for example, they'd reply, "There is no such thing as time." The answers were both non-responsive and a guard. I wanted to get past that guard, to learn what they really felt. I couldn't. I sensed something else. Each was, in her own way, a pretty girl. But there was a sameness about them that was much stronger than their individuality. I'd notice it again later that afternoon in talking to other female members of the family. Same expressions, same patterned responses, same tone of voice, same lack of distinct personality. The realization came with a shock. They reminded me less of human beings than Barbie dolls. Looking at Sandy's almost beatific smile, I remembered something that Frank Foles had told me, and a chill ran up and down my spine. While she was still in jail in Independence, Sandy had been overheard talking to one of the other girls in the family. Sandy had told her, "I've finally reached the point where I can kill my parents." Leslie, Uish, Snake, Brenda, Gypsy. Frank Foles arranged to have them brought over from the jail where they were still being held on charges stemming from the Barker raid. Like Squeaky and Sandy, they accepted my bribe, candy and gum, and told me nothing of importance. Their answers were as if rehearsed. Often they gave identical responses. If we were to get any of them to talk, I knew, we would have to separate them. There was a cohesion, a kind of cement that held them together. A part of it was undoubtedly their strange, and to me still puzzling, relationship with Charles Manson. Part was their shared experiences, the world known as the family. But I couldn't help wondering if another of the ingredients wasn't fear. Fear of what the others would say if they talked. Fear of what the others would do. The only way we could find out would be to keep them apart, and owing to the smallness of the jail, it couldn't be done in independence. Besides Manson, there was only one male family member still in custody, Clem Tufts, true name Steve Grogan. Jack Gardner, Foles' investigator, gave me the 18-year-old Grogan's rap sheet. 3-23-66, possession dangerous drugs, 6 months probation. 4-27-66, shoplifting, continued on probation. 6-23-66, disturbing the peace, continued on probation. 9-27-66, probation dismissed. 6-5-67, possession marijuana, counseled and released. 8-12-67, shoplifting, bail forfeiture. 1-22-68, loitering, closed after investigation. 4-5-69, grand theft money and prowling, released insufficient evidence. 5-20-69, grand theft auto, released insufficient evidence. 6-11-69, child molesting and indecent exposure. Grogan had been observed exposing himself to several children, ages 4 to 5 years. The kids wanted me to, he explained to arresting officers who had caught him in the act. I violated the law. The thing fell out of my pants and the parents got excited, he later told a court-appointed psychiatrist. After interviewing Grogan, the psychiatrist ruled against committing him to Camarillo State Hospital because the minor is much too aggressive to remain in a setting which does not provide containment facilities. The court decided otherwise, sending him to Camarillo for a 90-day observation period. He remained a grand total of 2 days, then walked away, aided, I would later learn, by one of the girls from the family. His escape had occurred on July 19, 1969. He was back at Spawn in time for the Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca murders. He was arrested in the August 16th Spawn raid, but was released 2 days later, in time to behead Shorty Shea. Currently, as a result of the Barker raid, he was charged with grand theft auto and possession of an illegal weapon, i.e. the sawed-off shotgun. I asked Foles the present status of the case. He said that at the instigation of Grogan's attorney, he had been examined by two psychiatrists who had decided that he was presently insane. I told Foles I hoped he would request a jury trial and fight the insanity plea. If I brought Clem to trial in Los Angeles, charged with participating in the Tate murders, I didn't want the defense introducing evidence that a court in Inyo County had already found him insane. Frank agreed to go along with this. At the moment, our case against Grogan was so thin as to be non-existent. There was no proof that Donald Shorty Shea was even dead. To date, no body had been found. As for the Tate murders, all we had was DiCarlo's statement that Clem had told him, "We got five piggies." There was no way we could use that statement in court if there was a joint trial. In 1965, the California Supreme Court ruled, in the case of People v. Aranda, that the prosecution cannot introduce into evidence a statement made by one defendant which implicates a co-defendant. Since Aranda would have a bearing on all the trials involving the Manson family members, a simplified explanation is in order. For example, if there were a joint trial with more than one defendant, we couldn't use Susan Atkins' statement to Ronnie Howard, "We did it," the plural being inadmissible because it implicated co-defendants. We could, however, use her statement, "I stabbed Sharon Tate." it is possible to sanitize some statements so they don't violate Aranda. Susan Atkins' admission to Whiteley and Gunther, "I went to Gary's house with Bobby Beausoleil," could be edited to "I went to Gary's house," although a good defense attorney can fight and, depending on the prosecutor and judge, sometimes win the exclusion of even that. But when it came to the pronoun "we," there was no way we could get around it. Therefore, Manson's statement to Springer, "We knocked off five of them just the other night," was useless. As was Clem's remark to DiCarlo, "We got five piggies." Manson and Grogan could have made such confessions on nationwide TV, and if there was a joint trial, we could never use their remarks against them. So we had virtually nothing on Clem. In going through Grogan's file, I noticed that one of his brothers had made application for the California Highway Patrol. I made note of this, thinking maybe his brother could influence Clem to cooperate with us. DiCarlo had described Grogan in two words: he's nuts. In his police photograph, big, wide grin, chipped front tooth, moronic stare, he did look idiotic. I asked Foles for copies of the recent psychiatric reports. Asked, "Why do you hate your father?" Grogan replied, "I'm my father and I don't hate myself." He denied the use of drugs. "I have my own bennies, adrenaline. It's called fear." He claimed that love is everything, but according to one psychiatrist, he also revealed that he could not accept the philosophy of interracial brotherhood. Quotes supposedly from the Bible with sexual correlation were given in defense of his attitude. Other quotes from Clem: "I'm dying a little every day. My ego is dying and knows he is dying and struggles hard. When you're free of ego, you're free of everything. Whatever you say is right for yourself. Whoever you think I am, that's who I am." The philosophy of Clem or Charles Manson? I'd heard the same thoughts in several instances, even identical words, from the girls. If the psychiatrists had examined one of Manson's followers and on the basis of such responses found him insane, what of his leader? I saw Charles Manson for the first time that day. He was walking from the jail to the courtroom for arraignment on the Michigan loader arson charge and was accompanied by five sheriff's deputies. I hadn't realized how small he was. He was just 5 feet two. He was thin, of slight build, a shade hunchbacked, wore his brown hair very long, almost to his shoulders, and had a good start on a beard, grown, I'd noticed in comparing the LASO and Inyo mugshots after his arrest in the Spahn Ranch raid. He wore fringed buckskins, which were not inexpensive. Though handcuffed, his walk was casual, not stiff, as though he was completely at ease. I could not believe that this little guy had done all the things it was said he had. He looked anything but a heavyweight. Yet I knew that to underrate him would be the biggest mistake I could make. For if the Atkins and DiCarlo stories were true, he was not only capable of committing murder himself, he also possessed the incredible power to command others to kill for him. Manson's girls had talked a great deal about the Indian concept of karma. It was like a boomerang, they said. Whatever you threw out would eventually come back to you. I wondered if Manson himself really believed this, and if he sensed that nearly 3.5 months after these hideous murders, his own karma was finally returning. He must. You don't assign five sheriff's deputies to an arson suspect. If he didn't know now, he would soon enough, when the jail grapevine repeated some of the questions we'd been asking. Before leaving Independence, I gave Frank Foles both my home and office numbers. If there were any developments, I wanted to be notified, whatever the hour. Manson had pleaded not guilty to the arson charge, and his bail had been set at $25,000. If anyone attempted to meet it, I wanted to know immediately, so we could move fast on the murder charges. It might mean revealing our case before we were ready to do so, but the alternative was worse. Aware that he was suspected of murder, once free, Manson would probably split. And with Manson at large, it would be extremely difficult to get anyone to talk. November 22nd to 23rd, 1969. That weekend I went through LAPD's files on the Tate-LaBianca murders, the Inyo County files, LASO's reports on the Spahn Ranch raid and other contacts with the family, and numerous rap sheets. LAPD had conducted over 450 interviews on Tate alone, although they had netted less than had a 10-cent phone call from an ex-hooker. I had to familiarize myself with what had and hadn't been done. I was especially interested in seeing if I could find any link between the Tate-LaBianca victims and the Manson clan. Also, I was looking for some clue as to the motive behind the slayings. Occasionally, writers refer to motiveless crimes. I've never encountered such an animal, and I'm convinced that none such exists. It may be unconventional. It may be apparent only to the killer or killers. It may even be largely unconscious. But every crime is committed for a reason. The problem, especially in this case, was finding it. After listening to the 7-hour taped interview with Daniel DiCarlo, I began studying the criminal record of one Manson, Charles M. I wanted to get to know the man I would be up against. Charles Manson was born No Name Maddox on November 12, 1934, in Cincinnati, Ohio, the illegitimate son of a 16-year-old girl named Kathleen Maddox. As with almost everything else written about Manson's early years, even his date of birth is usually given erroneously, although for an understandable reason. Unable to remember her child's birthday, the mother changed it to November 11th, which was Armistice Day, and an easier date to remember. Though Manson himself would later state that his mother was a teenage prostitute, other relatives say she was simply loose. One remarked, she ran around a lot, drank, got in trouble. Whatever the case, she lived with a succession of men. One, a much older man named William Manson, whom she married, was around just long enough to provide a surname for the youth. The identity of Charles Manson's father was something of a mystery. In 1936, Kathleen filed a bastardy suit in Boyd County, Kentucky, against one Colonel Scott. His first name remains unknown. Even in official records, he is referred to as Colonel Scott, a resident of Ashland, Kentucky. On April 19, 1937, the court awarded her a judgment of $25 plus $5 a month for the support of Charles Mills Manson. Though it was an agreed judgment, Colonel Scott apparently didn't honor it, for as late as 1940, Kathleen was attempting to file an attachment on his wages. Most accounts state that Colonel Scott died in 1954. Though this has never been officially verified, Manson himself apparently believed it. He also stated on numerous occasions that he never met his father. According to her own relatives, Kathleen would leave the child with obliging neighbors for an hour, then disappear for days or weeks. Usually his grandmother or maternal aunt would have to claim him. Most of his early years were spent with one or the other, in West Virginia, Kentucky, or Ohio. In 1939, Kathleen and her brother Luther robbed a Charleston, West Virginia service station, knocking out the attendant with Coke bottles. They were sentenced to 5 years in the state penitentiary for armed robbery. While his mother was in prison, Manson lived with his aunt and uncle in McMeekin, West Virginia. Manson would later tell his counselor at the National Training School for Boys that his uncle and aunt had some marital difficulty until they became interested in religion and became very extreme. A very strict aunt, who thought all pleasures sinful but who gave him love. A promiscuous mother, who let him do anything he wanted just so long as he didn't bother her. The youth was caught in a tug-of-war between the two. Paroled in 1942, Kathleen reclaimed Charles, then 8. The next several years were a blur of run-down hotel rooms and newly introduced uncles, most of whom, like his mother, drank heavily. In 1947, she tried to have him put in a foster home, but none being available, the court sent him to the Jabot School for Boys, a caretaking institution in Terre Haute, Indiana. He was 12 years old. According to school records, he made a poor institutional adjustment, and his attitude towards schooling was at best only fair. Though during the short lapses when Charles was pleasant and feeling happy, he presented a likable boy, he had a tendency toward moodiness and a persecution complex. He remained at Jabalt 10 months, then ran away, returning to his mother. She didn't want him, and he ran away again. Burglarizing a grocery store, he stole enough money to rent a room. He then broke into several other stores, stealing, among other things, a bicycle. Caught during a burglary, he was placed in the juvenile center in Indianapolis. He escaped the next day. When he was apprehended, the court, erroneously informed that he was Catholic, made arrangements through a local priest to have him accepted at Father Flanagan's Boys Town. He didn't make its distinguished alumni list. 4 days after his arrival, he and another boy, Blackie Nielsen, stole a car and fled to the home of Blackie's uncle in Peoria, Illinois. En route, they committed 2 armed robberies, one a grocery store, the other a gambling casino. Among criminals, as in the law itself, a distinction is made between nonviolent and violent crimes. Manson had graduated, committing his first armed robbery at age 13. The uncle was glad to see them. Both boys were small enough to slip through skylights. A week after their arrival in Peoria, the pair broke into a grocery store and stole $1,500. For their efforts, the uncle gave them $150. 2 weeks later, they tried a repeat, but this time they were caught. Both talked, implicating the uncle. Still only 13, Charles Manson was sent to the Indiana School for Boys at Plainfield. He remained there 3 years, running away a total of 18 times. According to his teachers, he professed no trust in anyone and did good work only for those from whom he figured he could obtain something. In February 1951, Charles Manson and 2 other 16-year-olds escaped and headed for California. For transportation, they stole cars. For support, they burglarized gas stations. Manson would later estimate they hit 15 or 20 before, just outside Beaver, Utah, a roadblock set up for a robbery suspect netted them instead. In taking a stolen vehicle across a state line, the youths had broken a federal law, the Dyer Act. This was the beginning of a pattern for Charles Manson of committing federal crimes, which carry far stiffer sentences than local or state offenses. On March 9, 1951, Manson was ordered confined to the National Training School for Boys in Washington, D.C., until reaching his majority. Detailed records were kept on Charles Manson during the time he was there. I would not obtain the results of these until much later. However, portions are quoted here. On arrival, he was given a battery of aptitude and intelligence tests. Manson's IQ was 109. Though he had completed 4 years of school, he remained illiterate. Intelligence, mechanical aptitude, manual dexterity, all average. Subject liked best, music. Observed his first caseworker with considerable understatement, Charles is a 16-year-old boy who has had an unfavorable family life, if it can be called family life at all. He was, the caseworker concluded, aggressively antisocial. 1 month after his arrival, this boy tries to give the impression that he is trying hard to adjust, although he actually is not putting forth any effort in this respect. I feel in time he will try to be a wheel in the cottage. After 3 months, Manson has become somewhat of an institution politician. He does just enough work to get by on. Restless and moody most of the time, the boy would rather spend his class time entertaining his friends. The report concluded, "It appears that this boy is a very emotionally upset youth who is definitely in need of some psychiatric orientation." Manson was anxious to be transferred to Natural Bridge Honor Camp, a minimum security institution. Because of his runaway record, school officials felt the opposite, i.e., transfer to a reformatory-type institution was in order, but they decided to withhold decision until after the boy had been examined by a psychiatrist. On June 29, 1951, Charles Manson was examined by a Dr. Block. The psychiatrist noted the marked degree of rejection, instability, and psychic trauma in Manson's background. His sense of inferiority in relation to his mother was so pronounced, Block said, that he constantly felt it necessary to suppress any thoughts about her. Because of his diminutive stature, his illegitimacy, and the lack of parental love, he is constantly striving for status with the other boys. To attain this, Manson had developed certain facile techniques for dealing with people. These, for the most part, consist of a good sense of humor and an ability to ingratiate himself. This could add up to a fairly slick, institutionalized youth, but one is left with the feeling that behind all this lies an extremely sensitive boy who is not yet given up in terms of securing some kind of love and affection from the world. Though the doctor observed that Manson was quite unable to accept any kind of authoritative direction, he found that he accepted with alacrity the offer of psychiatric interviews. If he found this suspicious, the doctor did not indicate it in his report. For the next 3 months, he gave Manson individual psychotherapy. It may be presumed that Charles Manson also worked on the doctor, for in his October 1st report, Dr. Block was convinced that what Manson most required were experiences which would build up his self-confidence. In short, he needed to be trusted. The doctor recommended the transfer. It would appear that Charles Manson had conned his first psychiatrist. Though the school authorities considered him at best a calculated risk, they accepted the doctor's recommendation, and on October 24, 1951, he was transferred to Natural Bridge Camp. That November, he turned 17. Shortly after his birthday, he was visited by his aunt, who told the authorities that she would supply a home and employment for him if he was released. He was due for a parole hearing in February 1952, and with her offer, his chances looked good. Instead, less than a month before the hearing, he took a razor blade and held it against another boy's throat while he sodomized him. As a result of the offense, he lost 97 days good time, and on January 18, 1952, he was transferred to the Federal Reformatory at Petersburg, Virginia. He was considered dangerous, one official observing he shouldn't be trusted across the street. By August, he had committed 8 serious disciplinary offenses, 3 involving homosexual acts. His progress report, if it could be called that, stated, "Manson definitely has homosexual and assaultive tendencies. He was classified safe only under supervision. For the protection of himself as well as others, the authorities decided to transfer him to a more secure institution, the Federal Reformatory at Chillicothe, Ohio. He was sent there on September 22, 1952. From the Chillicothe Files, associates with troublemakers, seems to be the unpredictable type of inmate who will require supervision both at work and in quarters. In spite of his age, he is criminally sophisticated, regarded as grossly unsuited for retention in an open reformatory-type institution such as Chillicothe." This from a report written less than a month after his transfer there. Then, suddenly, Manson changed. For the rest of the year, there were no serious disciplinary offenses. Except for minor infractions of the rules and a consistently poor attitude toward authority, his good conduct continued into 1953. A progress report that October noted, "Manson has shown a marked improvement in his general attitude and cooperation with officers, and is also showing an active interest in the educational program. He is especially proud of the fact that he raised his educational level from lower fourth to upper seventh grade, and that he can now read most material and use simple arithmetic. Because of his educational advancement and his good work habits in the transportation unit, where he repaired and maintained vehicles belonging to the institution, on January 1, 1954, he was given a meritorious service award." Far more important to Charles Manson, on May 8, 1954, he was granted parole. He was 19. One of the conditions of his parole was that he live with his aunt and uncle in McMeekin. He did, for a time. Then, when his mother moved to nearby Wheeling, he joined her. They seemed drawn together, yet unable to stand each other for any length of time. Since 14, Charles Manson's only sexual contacts had been homosexual. Shortly after his release, he met a 17-year-old McMeekin girl, Rosalie Jean Willis, a waitress in the local hospital. They were married in January 1955. For support, Manson worked as a busboy, service station helper, parking lot attendant. He also boosted cars. He would later admit to stealing 6. He appeared to have learned nothing. He took at least 2 across state lines. 1, stolen in Wheeling, West Virginia, he abandoned in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The 2nd, a 1951 Mercury, he drove from Bridgeport, Ohio, to Los Angeles in July 1955, accompanied by his now pregnant wife. Manson had finally made it to the Golden State. He was arrested less than 3 months later and admitted both Dyer Act violations. Taken to federal court, he pleaded guilty to the theft of the Mercury and asked for psychiatric help, stating, "I was released from Chillicothe in 1954, and having been confined for 9 years, I was badly in need of psychiatric treatment. I was mentally confused and stole a car as a means of mental release for the confused state of mind that I was in." The judge requested a psychiatric report. Manson was examined on October 26, 1955, by Dr. Edwin McNeil. He gave the psychiatrist a much abbreviated version of his past, stating that he was first sent to an institution for being mean to my mother. Of his wife, Manson said, "She is the best wife a guy could want. I didn't realize how good she was until I got in here. I beat her at times. She writes to me all the time. She's going to have a baby." He also told McNeil that he spent so much time in institutions that he never really learned much of what real life on the outside was all about. He said that now he has a wife and is about to become a father, it has become important to him to try to be on the outside and be with his wife. He said she is the only one he has ever cared about in his life. Dr. McNeil observed, "It is evident that he has an unstable personality and that his environmental influences throughout most of his life have not been good. In my opinion, this boy is a poor risk for probation. On the other hand, he has spent 9 years in institutions with apparently little benefit except to take him out of circulation. With the incentive of a wife and probable fatherhood, it is possible that he might be able to straighten himself out. I would therefore respectfully recommend to the court that probation be considered in this case under careful supervision." Accepting the suggestion, on November 7, 1955, the court gave Manson 5 years probation. There remained the Florida charge. Though his chances of getting probation on it were excellent, before the hearing, he skipped. A warrant was issued for his arrest. He was picked up in Indianapolis on March 14, 1956, and returned to Los Angeles. His probation was revoked, and he was sentenced to 3 years' imprisonment at Terminal Island, San Pedro, California. By the time Charles Manson Jr. was born, his father was back in jail. "This inmate will no doubt be in serious difficulty soon," wrote the orientation officer. "He is young, small, baby-faced, and unable to control himself." Given another battery of tests, Manson received average marks in all the categories except word meaning, where he had a high score. His IQ was now 121. With some perception, when it came to his work assignment, Manson requested a small detail where he is not with too many men. He states he has a tendency to cut up and misbehave if he is around a gang. Rosalie moved in with his mother, now living in Los Angeles, and during his first year at Terminal Island, she visited him every week, his mother somewhat less frequently. Manson's work habits and attitudes range from good to poor, noted his March 1957 progress report. However, as the time of his parole hearing approaches, his work performance report has jumped from good to excellent, showing that he is capable of a good adjustment if he wants to. His parole hearing was set for April 22nd. In March, his wife's visits ceased. Manson's mother told him Rosalie was living with another man. In early April, he was transferred to the Coast Guard unit under minimal custody. On April 10th, he was found in the Coast Guard parking lot, dressed in civilian clothes, wiring the ignition of a car. Subsequently indicted for attempted escape, he pleaded guilty, and an extra 5 years probation was tacked onto the end of his current sentence. On April 22nd, the parole request was denied. Rosalie filed for divorce not long after this, the divorce becoming final in 1958. She retained custody of Charles Jr., remarried, and had no further contact with Manson or his mother. April 1958, Annual Review. His work performance was sporadic. His behavior continued to be erratic and moody. Almost without exception, he would let down anyone who went to bat for him, the report noted. For example, he was selected to attend the current Dale Carnegie course, being passed over a number of other applicants because it was felt that this course might be beneficial in his case, and he urgently desired enrollment. After attending a few sessions and apparently making excellent progress, he quit in a mood of petulance and is since engaged in no educational activity. Manson was called an almost classic textbook case of the correctional institutional inmate. He is a very difficult case, and it is impossible to predict his future adjustment with any degree of accuracy. He was released September 30th, 1958, on 5 years parole. By November, Manson had found a new occupation, pimping. His teacher was Plus Frank Peters, a Malibu bartender and known procurer with whom he was living. Unknown to Manson, he was under surveillance by the FBI and had been since his release from prison. The federal agents, who were looking for a fugitive who had once lived with Peters, told Manson's parole officer that his first string consisted of a 16-year-old girl named Judy, whom he had personally turned out. As additional support, he was getting money from Fat Flo, an unattractive Pasadena girl who had wealthy parents. His parole officer called him in for a talk. Manson denied he was pimping, said he was no longer living with Peters, promised never to see Judy again, but stated that he wished to continue his relationship with Flo for money and sex. After all, he said, he had been in a long time. After the interview, the parole officer wrote, "This certainly is a very shaky probationer, and it seems just a matter of time before he gets in further trouble." On May 1st, 1959, Manson was arrested attempting to cash a forged U.S. Treasury check for $37.50 in Ralph's, a Los Angeles supermarket. According to the arresting officers, Manson told them he had stolen the check from a mailbox. Two more federal offenses. LAPD turned Manson over to Secret Service agents for questioning. What then happened was somewhat embarrassing. Unfortunately for them, read a report of the incident, the check itself has disappeared. They feel certain subject took it off table and swallowed it when they momentarily turned their backs. The charges remained, however. In mid-June, an attractive 19-year-old girl named Leona called on Manson's parole officer and told him she was pregnant by Charlie. The parole officer was skeptical and wanted to see a medical report. He also began checking her background. With the aid of an attorney, Manson obtained a deal. If he would plead guilty to forging the check, the mail theft charge would be dropped. The judge ordered a psychiatric examination, and Dr. McNeil examined Manson a second time. When Manson appeared in court on September 28, 1959, Dr. McNeil, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Probation Department all recommended against probation. Leona also appeared and made a tearful plea in Manson's behalf. They were deeply in love, she told the judge, and would marry if Charlie were freed. Though it was proved that Leona had lied about being pregnant and that she had an arrest record as a prostitute under the name Candy Stevens, the judge, evidently moved by Leona's plea and Manson's promise to make good, gave the defendant a 10-year sentence, then suspended it and placed him on probation. Manson returned to pimping and breaking federal laws. By December, he had been arrested by LAPD twice for grand theft auto and the use of stolen credit cards. Both charges were dismissed for lack of evidence. That month, he also took Leona, a.k.a. Candy, and a girl named Elizabeth from Needles, California, to Lordsburg, New Mexico, for purposes of prostitution, violating the Mann Act, still another federal beef. Held briefly, questioned, then released, he was given the impression that he had beat the rap. He must have suspected that the investigation was continuing, however. Possibly to prevent Leona from testifying against him, he did marry her, though he didn't inform his probation officer of this. He remained free throughout January 1960 while the FBI prepared its case. Late in February, Manson's probation officer was visited by an irate parent, plus Ralph Samuels, from Detroit. Samuels' daughter, plus Joanne, 19, had come to California in response to an ad for an airline stewardess school, only to learn, after paying her tuition, that the school was a fraud. She had $700 in savings, however, and together with another disillusioned student, plus Beth Belden, had rented an apartment in Hollywood. About November 1959, Joanne had the misfortune to meet Charles Manson, who introduced himself, complete with printed card, as President, Three Star Enterprises, Nightclub, Radio, and TV Productions. Manson conned her into investing her savings in his non-existent company, drugged and raped her roommate, and got Joanne pregnant. It was an ectopic pregnancy, the fetus growing in one of the fallopian tubes, and she nearly died. The probation officer could offer little more than a sympathetic ear, however, for Charles Manson had disappeared. A bench warrant was issued, and on April 28th, a federal grand jury indicted him on the Mann Act violation. He was arrested June 1st in Laredo, Texas, after police picked up one of his girls on a prostitution charge, and brought back to Los Angeles, where, on June 23, 1960, the court ruled he had violated his probation and ordered him returned to prison to serve out his 10-year sentence. The judge observed, "If there ever was a man who demonstrated himself completely unfit for probation, he is it." This was the same judge who had granted him probation the previous September. The Mann Act charge was later dropped. For a full year, Manson remained in the Los Angeles County Jail while appealing the revocation. The appeal was denied, and in July 1961, he was sent to the United States Penitentiary at McNeil Island, Washington. He was 26. According to staff evaluation, Manson had become something of an actor. He hides his loneliness, resentment, and hostility behind a facade of superficial ingratiation. An energetic, young-appearing person whose verbalization flows quite easily, he gestures profusely and can dramatize situations to hold the listener's attention. Then a statement which, in one form or another, was to reappear often in his prison records, and much later in post-prison interviews. He has commented that institutions have become his way of life, and that he receives security in institutions which is not available to him in the outside world. Manson gave as his claimed religion Scientologist, stating that he has never settled upon a religious formula for his beliefs and is presently seeking an answer to his question in the new mental health cult known as Scientology. Scientology, an outgrowth of science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics, was just coming into vogue at this time. Manson's teacher, i.e. auditor, was another convict, Lanier Rayner. Manson would later claim that while in prison, he achieved Scientology's highest level, Theta Clear. In one of his pamphlets, Hubbard defined a clear as one who has straightened up this lifetime. It is rather hard to see how this might apply to Charles Manson. Although Manson remained interested in Scientology much longer than he did in any other subject except music, it appears that, like the Dale Carnegie course, he stuck with it only as long as his enthusiasm lasted, then dropped it, extracting and retaining a number of terms and phrases, auditing, cease to exist, coming to now, and some concepts, karma, reincarnation, etc., which, perhaps fittingly, Scientology had borrowed in the first place. He was still interested in Scientology when his annual progress report was written that September. Furthermore, according to the report, that interest has led him to make a semi-professional evaluation of his personality, which strangely enough is quite consistent with the evaluations made by previous social studies. He appears to have developed a certain amount of insight into his problems through his study of this discipline. Manson is making progress for the first time in his life. The report also noted that Manson is active in softball, basketball, and croquet, and is a member of the drama club and the self-improvement group. He had become somewhat of a fanatic at practicing the guitar. He in fact requested a transfer to Leavenworth, considered a much tougher institution, because he claimed he would be allowed to practice his guitar more often. The request was denied. He held one fairly responsible job 11 months, the longest he held any prison assignment, before being caught with contraband in his cell and reassigned to janitorial work. The annual report that September took a close, hard look at the 28-year-old convict. Charles Manson has a tremendous drive to call attention to himself. Generally, he is unable to succeed in positive acts, therefore he often resorts to negative behavior to satisfy this drive. In his effort to find himself, Manson peruses different religious philosophies, e.g., Scientology and Buddhism. However, he never remains long enough with any given teachings to reap meaningful benefits. Even these attempts and his cries for help represent a desire for attention with only superficial meaning. Manson has had more than the usual amount of staff attention, yet there is little indication of change in his demeanor. In view of his deep-seated personality problems, continuation of institutional treatment is recommended. On October 1, 1963, prison officials were informed, according to court papers received in this institution, that Manson was married to a Leona Manson in 1959 in the state of California, and that the marriage was terminated by divorce on April 10, 1963, in Denver, Colorado, on grounds of mental cruelty and conviction of a felony. One child, Charles Luther Manson, is alleged to have been of this union. This is the only reference in any of Manson's records to his second marriage and second child. Manson's annual review of September 1964 revealed a clear conduct record, but little else encouraging. His past pattern of employment instability continues, seems to have an intense need to call attention to himself, remains emotionally insecure, and tends to involve himself in various fanatical interests. Those fanatical interests weren't identified in the prison reports, but at least several are known. In addition to Scientology and his guitar, there was now a third. In January 1964, "I Want to Hold Your Hand" became the number one song on U.S. record charts. With the New York arrival of the Four Liverpool Lads the following month, the United States experienced, later than Great Britain, but with no less intensity, the phenomenon known as Beatlemania. According to former inmates at McNeil, Manson's interest in the Beatles was almost an obsession. It didn't necessarily follow that he was a fan. There was more than a little jealousy in his reaction. He told numerous people that, given the chance, he could be much bigger than the Beatles. One person he told this to was Alvin Karpis, lone survivor of the Ma Barker gang. Manson had struck up a friendship with the aging gangster after learning he could play the steel guitar. Karpis taught Manson how. Again, an observable pattern. Manson managed to get something from almost everyone with whom he associated. May 1966. Manson continues to maintain a clear conduct record. Recently, he has been spending most of his free time writing songs, accumulating about 80 or 90 of them during the past year, which he ultimately hopes to sell following release. He also plays the guitar and drums, and is hopeful that he can secure employment as a guitar player or as a drummer or singer. He shall need a great deal of help in the transition from institution to the free world. In June 1966, Charles Manson was returned to Terminal Island for release purposes. August 1966. Manson is about to complete his 10-year term. He has a pattern of criminal behavior and confinement that dates to his teen years. This pattern is one of instability, whether in free society or a structured institutional community. Little can be expected in the way of change in his attitude, behavior, or mode of conduct. This last report noted that Manson had no further interest in academic or vocational training, that he was no longer an advocate of Scientology, that he has come to worship his guitar and music, and finally, he has no plans for release, as he says he has nowhere to go. The morning Charles Manson was to be freed, he begged the authorities to let him remain in prison. Prison had become his home, he told them. He didn't think he could adjust to the world outside. His request was denied. He was released at 8:15 a.m. on March 21, 1967, and given transportation to Los Angeles. That same day, he requested and received permission to go to San Francisco. It was there, in the Haight-Ashbury section, that spring, that the family was born. Charles Manson was 32 years old. Over 17 of those years, more than half his life, had been spent in institutions. In those 17 years, Manson had only been examined by a psychiatrist 3 times, and then very superficially. I was surprised in studying Manson's record to find no sustained history of violence. Armed robbery, age 13, homosexual rape, age 17, wife beating, age 20, that was it. I was more than surprised. I was amazed at the number of federal offenses. Probably 99 out of 100 criminals never see the inside of a federal court. Yet here was Manson, described as criminally sophisticated, violating the Dyer Act, the Mann Act, stealing from the mails, forging a government check, and so on. Had Manson been convicted of comparable offenses in state courts, he probably would have served less than 5 years instead of over 17. Why? I could only guess. Perhaps, as he said before his reluctant release from Terminal Island, prison was the only home he had. It was also possible that, consciously or unconsciously, he sought out those offenses that carried the most severe punishments. A third speculation, and I wasn't overlooking the possibility that it could be a combination of all three, was a need, amounting almost to a compulsion, to challenge the strongest authority. I was a long way from understanding Charles Manson. Though I could see patterns in his conduct which might be clues to his future actions, a great deal was missing. Burglar, car thief, forger, pimp. Was this the portrait of a mass murderer? I had far more questions than answers, and as yet, not even a clue as to the motive. November 24th to 26th, 1969. Although Lieutenants Helder and LePage remained in charge of the Tate and LaBianca cases, the assignments were more jurisdictional than operational, since each was in charge of numerous other homicide investigations. 19 detectives had originally been assigned to the 2 cases. That number had now been cut to 6. Moreover, for some odd reason, though there were only 2 victims in the LaBianca slayings, 4 detectives remained assigned to that case. Sergeants Philip Sartucci, Mike Nielsen, Manuel Chick Gutierrez, and Frank Patchett. But on Tate, where there were 5 victims, there were only 2 detectives, Sergeants Robert Calkins and Mike McGann. I called Calkins and McGann in for a conference and gave them a list of things I needed done. A few samples. Interview Terry Melcher. Check the fingerprints of every known family member against the 25 unmatched latents found at 10,050 Cielo Drive. Put out a want on Charles Tex Montgomery, using the description on Inyo Deputy Sheriff Cox's August 21, 1969 FIR card. Male, Caucasian, 6 feet, 145 pounds, slim build, ruddy complexion, born December 2, 1945. If the case breaks before we arrest him, I told them, we may never find him. Show photos of every family member to Chapman, Gerritsen, the Tate Gardeners, and the families, friends, and business associates of the victims. If there's a link, I want to know about it. Check everyone in the family to see who wears glasses, and determine if the pair found at the Tate murder scene belongs to a family member. How do we do that? Calkins asked. They're not about to admit it. I presume you talk to their acquaintances, parents, relatives, to any of the family members like Kitty Lutzinger and Stephanie Schramm who were willing to cooperate, I told him. If you can check out the glasses with eye doctors all over the United States and Canada, you can certainly check out some 35 people. This was our initial estimate of the size of the family. We'd later learn that at various times it numbered 100 or more. The hardcore members, i.e. those who remained for any length of time and who were privy to what was going on, numbered between 25 and 30. Something occurred to me. You did check out Gerritsen, didn't you, to see if those glasses were his? They weren't sure. They'd have to get back to me on that. I later learned that although Gerritsen had been the first, and for a time the only suspect in the murders, no one had thought to ascertain if those glasses, the single most important clue found at the murder scene, belonged to him. They hadn't even asked him if he wore glasses. It turned out he sometimes did. I learned this in talking to his attorney, Barry Tarlow. Eventually, I was able to get LAPD to contact the police in Lancaster, Ohio, Gerritsen's hometown, where he had returned after his release, and they obtained the specifics on Gerritsen's prescription from his local optometrist. Not even close. From the evidence I'd seen, I didn't believe Gerritsen was involved in the murders, but I didn't want a defense attorney popping up in court, pointing a finger, or rather a pair of eyeglasses, at an alternate suspect. I was also curious about whom those glasses belonged to. After Calkins and McGann left, I got in touch with the LaBianca detectives and gave them similar instructions regarding the photos and the Waverly Drive latents. Five of the Manson girls were still in jail in Independence. LAPD decided to bring them to Los Angeles for individual interrogation. They would be confined at Sybil Brand, but a keep-away would be placed on each. This meant they could have no contact with each other or with anyone else LAPD designated. For example, Susan Atkins. It was a good move on LAPD's part. There was a chance that, questioned separately, one or more might decide to talk. That evening, TV commentator George Putnam startled his listeners with the announcement that on Wednesday he would reveal who had committed the Tate murders. Our office called LAPD, who had their public relations spokesman, Lieutenant Hagen, contact Putnam and other representatives of the media, asking them to hold off, because publicity now would hurt our investigation. All the newspapers, wire services, and radio and TV stations agreed to sit on the story, but only for 1 week, until Monday, December 1st. The news was too big, and each was afraid someone else would try for a scoop. There had been a leak. It wouldn't be the last. On Tuesday the 25th, Frank Foles, the Inyo County DA, called, and we traded some information. Foles told me that Sandra Good had been overheard talking again. She had told another family member that Charlie was going to go alibi. If he was brought to trial for the Tate-LaBianca murders, they would produce evidence showing he wasn't even in Los Angeles at the time the murders occurred. I told Foles of a rumor I'd heard. According to McGann, a police informant in Las Vegas had told him that Charles, Tex Montgomery, and Bruce Davis had been seen there the previous day, driving a green panel Volkswagen. They had allegedly told someone that they were attempting to raise enough money to bail out Manson. Failing in that, they intended to kill someone. Foles had heard similar rumblings among the Manson girls. He took them seriously enough to send his own family out of Inyo County over the Thanksgiving weekend. He remained behind, however, ready to forestall any bail attempt. After hanging up, I called Patchett and Gutierrez of the LaBianca team and told them I wanted a detailed report on Manson's activities the week of the murders. Unlike the Tate detectives, they didn't ask how to do it. They went out and did it, eventually giving me evidence which, together with other information we obtained, would blow any alibi defense to smithereens. That afternoon, McGann and Patchett re-interviewed Ronnie Howard, this time on tape. She provided several details she'd recalled since LAPD last talked to her, but nothing that was of help in the current investigation. We still didn't know who all the killers were. Wednesday, November 26th. Hung jury on Beausoleil, one of the deputy DAs yelled in the door of my office. 8-4 for conviction. The case had been so weak our office hadn't sought the death penalty. Also, the jury hadn't believed Danny DiCarlo. Brought in at the last minute without adequate preparation, he had not been a convincing witness. Later that day, LASO asked my office if I would take over the prosecution of Beausoleil in his new trial, and I was assigned this case in addition to the two cases I was already handling. That same morning, Virginia Graham decided she had to tell someone what she knew. A few days earlier, her husband had visited her at Corona. Whispering through the wire screen in the visitor's room, she told him she had heard something about the Benedict Canyon murders and didn't know what to do. He advised her, "Mind your own business." But she would later state, "I can see a lot of things I don't say anything about, but this is sick. This is so bad that I don't know who could mind their own business with this." Virginia Graham would later state that she was unaware that Ronnie Howard had already talked to the police. However, a group of girls were transferred from Sybil Brand to Corona shortly before this, and it's possible they carried along some jail scuttlebutt. Having failed to get an appointment with Dr. Dreiser, Virginia instead went to her counselor. The authorities at Corona called LAPD. At 3:15 that afternoon, Sergeant Nielsen arrived at the prison and began taping her story. Unlike Ronnie, who was unsure whether 4 or 5 people were involved in the Tate homicides, Virginia recalled Sadie saying there were 3 girls and 1 man. Like Ronnie, however, she presumed the man, Charles, was Manson. The individual questioning of the 5 girls took place that afternoon and evening at Sybil Brand. Sergeant Manuel Chick Gutierrez interviewed Diane Bluestein, a.k.a. Snake, true name Diane Lake, given age 21, true age 16. The interview was taped. Listening to the tapes later, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Question. My name is Sergeant Gutierrez, and I'm with the Los Angeles Police Department, and I work homicide. I've talked to several of the girls. The girls have been real nice, and we've had some long, long chats. We know a lot of things that went on over at Spawn. We know a lot that happened other places. We know who is involved and who is not involved. We also know things that maybe you don't know, that we're not going to tell you until the right time comes up, but we've got to talk to everybody who was involved, and I think you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Charlie and the family and everybody. I don't know how tight you are with the family. You're probably real tight with them. But somebody's going to go down the tubes, and somebody's going to get the pill in the gas chamber for a whole bunch of murders which you are a part of, or so some other people have indicated. There was no evidence whatsoever that Diane was involved in any of the murders, but Chick wasn't deterred by this. Now I'm here for one specific reason, and that's to listen to you, see what you've got to say, so I can go to the district attorney and tell him, look, this is what Diane told me, and she's willing to turn state's evidence in return for her full release. We're not interested in nailing you. We're interested in the big guy. And you know who we're talking about, right, honey? Answer. No audible answer. Question. Now somebody's going to go to that gas chamber, you know that. This is just too big. This is the biggest murder of the century. You know that and I know it. So in order to protect yourself from getting even indicted or spending the rest of your life in jail, then you're going to have to come up with some answers. We know of about 14 murders right now, and you know which ones I'm talking about. Answer, unintelligible. Gutierrez accused her of involvement in all 14. He then said, I'm prepared to give you complete immunity, which means that if you are straight with me right down the line, I'll be straight with you, and I'll guarantee you that you will walk out of that jail a free woman, ready to start over again and never go back up there to Independence to do any time. I wouldn't say that unless I meant it, right? Actually, Sergeant Gutierrez did not have the authority to guarantee this. The granting of immunity is a complicated procedure, involving the approval not only of the police department but also of the district attorney's office, with the final decision being made by the court. Gutierrez offered it to her as casually as if it were a stick of gum. Commenting on her silence, Sergeant Gutierrez said, "Now what's that gonna prove, huh? Right now the only thing you're proving to me, honey, is that, heck, you're out there sticking your nose out for a guy by the name of Charlie. Now, what's Charlie? He got you guys in all this problem. You could have been out right now doing your thing, but here you're holding silent for what? For Charlie? Charlie ain't never gonna get out of that jail. You know that, right? Didn't we start out on good terms, huh?" Answer: yes. Question: okay. And I'm not about to beat you over the head with a hammer or hose and all that. All I want to do is talk to you friendly. Gutierrez interviewed Diane for nearly 2 hours, obtaining from the 16-year-old little more than the admission that she liked candy bars. Later, Diane Lake would become one of the prosecution's most important witnesses. But credit for this goes to the Inyo County authorities, in particular Gibbons and Gardner, who instead of threats, tried patient, sympathetic understanding. It made all the difference. Having got nothing from Diane, Gutierrez next interviewed Rachel Morse, a.k.a. Uish, true name Ruth Ann Morehouse, age 18. Ruth Ann was the girl Danny DiCarlo identified as his favorite sweetie, the same girl who at Barker Ranch had told him she couldn't wait to get her first pig. Unlike Diane, Ruth Ann answered Gutierrez's questions, though most of her replies were lies. She claimed she'd never heard of Shorty, Gary Hinman, or anyone named Katie. The reason she knew so little, she explained, was that she had been with the family only a short time, a month or so before the Spawn Ranch raid. All five girls said this, obviously by prearrangement. Question: I want to know everything you know because you're going to testify before that grand jury. Answer: I don't know anything. Question: then you're going to hang with the rest of them. You're going to go to the joint. If you don't start cooperating, you're going to go to the joint, and let me tell you what it is down there. They may drop that pill on you. They may drop that cyanide pill on you. Answer, nearly screaming: I haven't done anything. I don't know anything about it. Then, later: question: how old are you? Answer: 18. Question: that's old enough to go to the gas chamber. There was also no evidence linking her to any of the homicides, but Gutierrez told her 14 murders, and you're involved in each one. He also promised her complete immunity. You're either going to go up for murder or you are going to go free. And added, also, there is a $25,000 reward. Manon Minette, a.k.a. Gypsy, true name Catherine Scher, who at 27 was the oldest female member of the family, gave the detectives nothing of value. Nor did Brenda McCann, true name Nancy Pittman, age 18. It was otherwise, however, with 20-year-old Leslie Sangston. Leslie, whose true name, Van Houten, was not known to us at this time, was interviewed by Mike McGann. McGann tried using her parents, conscience, the hideousness of the murders, the implication that others had talked and involved her. None worked. What did work was Leslie's little girl cuteness, her "I know something you don't" game playing. Repeatedly, she tracked herself. Question: what did you hear about the Tate murders up there? Answer: I'm deaf. I didn't hear nothing. Laughs. Question: five people were killed up there on the hill, and I know three for sure that went up there. I think I know the fourth, and I don't know the fifth, but I suspect you do. Why are you holding back? You know what happened. Answer: I have a pretty good idea. Question. I want to know who was involved, how it went down, the little details. Answer. I told Mr. Patchett, in Independence, I'll tell him if I changed my mind. I haven't changed my mind yet. Question. You're going to have to talk about it someday. Answer. Not today. How did you ever trace it back to Spahn? Question. Who did you see leave the night of the 8th of August? Answer. Laughs. Oh, I went to bed early that night. Really, I don't want to talk about it. Question. Who went? Answer. That's what I don't want to talk about. All these were little admissions, if not of participation, at least of knowledge. Though she didn't want to talk about the murders, she didn't mind talking about the family. You couldn't meet a nicer group of people, she told McGann. Of all the guys at the ranch, I liked Clem the best. He's fun to be with. Clem, with the idiot grin, who liked to expose himself to little children. Sadie was really kind of a nice person, but she tends to be on the rough side. As Sharon Tate, Gary Hinman, and others had discovered. Bruce Davis was all talk, Leslie continued, always going on about how he was going to dynamite someone, but she was sure it was only talk. She commented on some of the others, but not Charlie. In common with the four other girls who had been brought down from Independence, she avoided the subject of Manson. Question. The family is no more, Leslie. Charlie was in jail. Clem was in jail. Zero had killed himself playing Russian roulette. Answer. Zero. Obviously shocked, she dropped her little girl role and pressed McGann for details. He told her that Bruce Davis had been present. Answer. Was Bruce playing it too? Question. No. Answer. Sarcastically. Zero was playing Russian roulette all by himself. Question. Kind of odd, isn't it? Answer. Yeah, it's odd. Sensing an advantage, McGann moved in. He told her that he knew five people had gone to the Tate residence, three girls and two men, and that one of the men was Charles Manson. Answer. I don't think Charlie was in on any of them. Leslie said she had heard only four people went to Tate. I would say that three of them were girls. I would say that there were probably more girls involved than men. Then, later, I heard one girl who didn't murder someone while they were up there. Question. Who is that? Answer. A girl by the name of Linda. Susan Atkins had told Ronnie Howard, in regard to the killings the second night, Linda wasn't in on this one, presumably meaning she had been along the first night. But until now, we had been unsure of this. Questioned, Leslie said she didn't know Linda's last name, that she was at Spahn only a short time and hadn't been arrested with them, and that she was a small girl, maybe 5'2", thin, with light brown hair. McGann asked her who had told her that Linda had been along on Tate. Leslie replied, petulantly, I don't remember. I don't remember who told me little details. Why was she so upset? McGann asked. Because so many of my friends are getting knocked off for reasons I don't even know about. McGann showed her the mugshots taken after the Barker raid. Though she had been present, she claimed she couldn't recognize most of the people. When handed one of a girl booked as Marnie Reeves, Leslie said, That's Katie. Question. Katie is Marnie Reeves. Leslie equivocated. She wasn't sure. She really didn't know any of these people all that well. Though she had lived with the family at both Spahn and Barker, she associated mostly with the motorcycle riders. She thought they were neat. McGann brought the questioning back to the murders. Leslie began playing games again, and in the process making admissions. She implied that she knew of 11 murders. Hinman, 1, Tate, 5, LaBianca, 2, Shea, 1, for a total of 9. But she declined to identify the other two. It was as if she were keeping score in a baseball game. There was a break in the questioning. It's standard police procedure to leave a suspect alone for a while, to think about his or her answers, to provide a transition between soft and hard interrogation. It also gives the officers an opportunity to visit the can. When McGann returned, he decided to shock Leslie some more. Question. Sadie has already told 15 people in the jailhouse that she was there, that she took part in it. Answer. That's incredible. Then, after a thoughtful pause, didn't she mention anyone else? Question. No, except for Charlie and Katie. Answer. She mentioned Charlie and Katie. Question. That's right. Answer. That's pretty nauseating. Question. She said Katie was there, and I know it was Marnie Reeves, and you know it was Marnie Reeves. At this point, McGann later told me, Leslie nodded her head affirmatively. Question. Sadie also said I went out the next night and killed two more people out in the hills. Answer. Sadie said that. Leslie was astonished. With good reason. Though we were as yet unaware of it, Leslie knew Susan Atkins had never entered the LaBianca residence. She knew that because she was one of the persons who had. After this, Leslie refused to answer any further questions. McGann asked her why. Answer, because if Zero was suddenly found playing Russian roulette, I could be found playing Russian roulette. Question, we'll give you 24-hour protection from now on. Answer, laughing sarcastically, oh, that would really be nice. I'd rather stay in jail. From Leslie, we learned that three girls had gone to the Tate residence, Sadie, Katie, and Linda. We also learned that Linda was one girl who didn't murder someone, the clear implication being that the two other girls had. Beyond Leslie's limited description of Linda, however, we knew nothing about her. We also knew that Katie was Marnie Reeves. According to her INEO arrest sheet, she was 5'6", weighed 120 pounds, had brown hair and blue eyes. Her photograph revealed a not very attractive girl, with very long hair and a somewhat mannish face. She looked older than 22, the age she gave. In comparing the Barker and Spahn photos, it was discovered that she had been arrested in the earlier raid also, at that time giving the name Mary Ann Scott. It was possible that Katie, Marnie Reeves, and Mary Ann Scott were all three aliases. She had been released a few days after her arrest at Barker, and her current whereabouts were unknown. In return, Leslie had learned a few things from McGann, that Tex, Katie, and Linda were still free, and more important, that Susan Atkins, a.k.a. Sadie Mae Glutz, was the snitch. Even with a keep-away on the girls, it wouldn't be long before this information got back to Manson. November 27th to 30th, 1969. We could have used a private line between Independence and L.A. Foles and I were averaging easily a dozen calls a day. Thus far, no attempt to meet Manson's bail or any sign of Tex or Bruce. However, there were reporters all over Independence, and KNXT was sending in a camera crew tomorrow to film Golar Wash. I had Lieutenant Hagen call the TV station. They told him they didn't plan to use the film until Monday, the 1st, the agreed date, but wouldn't promise an extension to Wednesday, which I wanted. Although nothing had seen print, the leaks continued. Chief Davis was enraged. He wanted to break the news himself. Someone was talking, and he wanted to know who. Determined to catch the culprit, he suggested that everyone working on the case, at LAPD and in the DA's office, take a polygraph. Even his own office ignored the suggestion, and I resisted the impulse to suggest that we concentrate on catching the killers instead. On Saturday, Sergeant Paget interviewed Greg Jacobson, a talent scout who was married to the daughter of old-time comedian Lou Costello. Jacobson had first met Charles Manson about May 1968 at the Sunset Boulevard home